Good morning, it's John Williams. Sarada's just finally exiting the studio. And we're here till 12 noon. On social media, you can always find us as WGN King John. We post our daily web poll question there, too. Yesterday, we said Illinois will reinstate thousands of suspended driver's licenses with people with non-moving violations. You know, you got a parking ticket, you lost your license eventually, maybe your job. We're going to just give those people their driver's licenses back. And they're also going to roll back some of the onerous fines. Good idea, bad idea. This was surprisingly even. 54% of you said good idea, but 46% of you who just park legally and don't break the law, 46% of you said this is a bad idea to reinstate the licenses of those people who lost them because they parked illegally. How about that? Yeah. Every now and then, I think I'm leading a parade. I turn around. Not many people there, Dave. I think, wow, everybody likes this. This is simple. Of course we all feel that way. Oh, no, we don't. I'll give you another one. This morning, I watched that Kansas-Kansas State fight last night, and it's just ugly. I think it is uglier than it is egregious, although it's bad. But I know I'm going to paint myself into a corner on this. But I have some sympathy for the players in the game. I think we do this with NFL players, baseball players, all of them. College basketball players, too. You put them in this arena. You get 10,000 people screaming. I'm sure the coaches beforehand said, this is really important, guys. Emotions well up and get high. And then you had this sort of bad sportsmanship on each side at the very end of the game where the guy steals the ball, goes in for the shot, the other guy spikes it, then he taunts him. Neither of those things should have happened. And then suddenly things go bad, and the next 12 seconds of those young people's lives is going to color the rest of their lives thereafter. And I want everybody to take a breath and say, okay, that was really bad. He didn't hit anybody with the chair.
Well, that's because they took the chair away from him.
I think it was one of those things where it was more for show. Aren't I amazing at interpreting this man's actions on TV? But I don't think he was going to crush it on anybody's head. And I think when you look at the individual actions of the individual players on replay, it was a lot of moving around. But let me put it this way. What should then happen to the players that get in a fight at the end of the game? That's the question. What should happen to them? Out for the rest of the season? So then they instantly start doing analysis and commentary last night. That young man should never wear a uniform again, says Dick Vitale.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh, shut up, Vitale. Really?
I don't know if it was Vitale who said that.
I think
Fran Fraschilla might have said that. Somebody said
I was cutting around to various games last night. Everybody had an opinion about it.
Yes.
Pretty sure Vitale said that, too.
He said something. It was the worst thing he ever saw.
Yeah. Okay. We'll pick it up here in just a minute.
Let's go.
I know. So the impeachment trial picks up again at noon. The Supreme Court Justice, John Roberts, said, you know what, you guys both need to behave better. I guess it's not surprising. You knew it was going to be partisan. And at one point, at least they didn't go all night long. At least they're not going to do these 24-hour dance marathons. But John Roberts said, okay, stop, or words to that effect. Back to the play-by-play. Oh, wait, first we have to do this, don't we? In fact, they should just send some ketamine to the Senate. When you look back at 2019, it says here, what stands out? And if the answer is anxiety and hopelessness, remember that this is a new year and a fresh start that awaits you. Anesthesiologist Dr. Balnandra uses ketamine to treat major depression. Ketamine is safe and in lower doses. It can quickly relieve depression and anxiety. It can also provide relief from PTSD and chronic pain. Ketamine's been called the greatest advancement in mental health in decades. Many antidepressants aren't effective or have bad side effects. Ketamine treatments from Dr. Nandra could reduce or eliminate your need for those drugs. Most people find relief in just a few hours or days. Treatment involves 6 IV infusions over 2 weeks in a private monitored setting. They now also offer the highly effective SGB treatment for PTSD. Schedule a free consultation. Call 844-9-IV-MEDS, 844-9-IV-MEDS, or visit KetamineChicago.com, KetamineChicago.com.
And a block to finish. And DeSosa blocks it, and now the bench is empty. Just unnecessary.
Yep. That's not good. This is bad.
This is bad. No good. Oh, this is terrible.
It looked terrible, that's for sure. It's the sort of thing you saw in the NBA in the 70s. College kids, pro players, just don't do that anymore. It was bizarre to watch, if nothing else, wasn't it?
You saw it in 2004 with the Indiana Pacers and the Detroit Pistons at the Palace of Auburn Hills, and that spilled into the stands.
Yeah.
And in this case, it kind of poured into it was an area for disabled seating behind the basket. Fortunately, it didn't appear anyone was hurt. The reports are no one did get hurt, and none of the spectators were injured. But it could have really, really been a lot worse than it was. But the visuals of this, John, the optics are really bad.
I can't argue that. But I think it's good that they don't have to make a decision last night or maybe even this morning. At some point today, Bill Self and the conference and the NCAA and the President of the United States and I believe the Emperor of Japan are all going to make statements about it, and that's fine. But I hope everybody just takes a breath and tries to get some perspective on what happened and what the appropriate punishment should be.
Well, Self, Bruce Weber, the coach of Kansas State, I mean, neither of them blame the other. You know, nobody's saying that this was, because everybody's wrong.
Yep, you're absolutely right.
And this is one of those deals, and it will be, I'm sure, up to the conference to decide ultimately. Self might impose his own punishment on the particular player, DeSosa, or maybe other players, and Weber might do the same. Ultimately, though, they'll have to adhere to whatever the conference
does. If I was the coach, I would put my arm around that kid in the locker room afterwards, and I would say something like this. I'd say, I know you. You're a good person. What we saw out there wasn't you. And what America saw out there wasn't you, but America saw that. So I love you. I support you. I'm going to be here for you, but you're not going to play anymore this year. It's not the end of the world. You can play next year or some other day, but that's it. But I would offer him support at the same time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. Just keep this in mind. And I'm not sure he should be allowed to play again this year, but if you say you can't play again this year, he's played in 17 games this year. He's started one game, but he's played in 17. So if he doesn't play again, this is 1 year of his career that's gone. He can't get that year back.
Yeah.
You know, and these guys have a limited amount of time to play college athletics.
That's, I think, one of the reasons why I'm just trying to be sympathetic. I think we ask these young athletes and these pro athletes to do so much and be so much for us. Be super entertaining. Well, listen, when Kansas walked off the floor at the end of this melee, the fans cheered. They cheered what they just saw. There was a lot of, yeah, let's, I don't know what the end of that sentence is, but it begins with, yeah, like, we got him, we beat him, you showed him. That's what was coming out of the stands. And I think these players are not immune to that. They get amped up too, and then, something went wrong. I think that's literally how it feels, not ever been in a situation like that. So we'll see what happens today. We're also reading today that Terry Jones, this is from the New York Times, who earned a spot in comedic lore as a member of the British troupe Monty Python, also had success as a director, screenwriter, and author, has died at the age of 77. Mr. Jones, they write, and Mr. Terry Gilliam, among others, but Jones and Gilliam jointly directed the first film after something completely different, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, 1975, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, Monty Python's Life of Brian. You know him for some specific lines in there. You know him for some great movies. There is a population of men of a certain generation who can quote a lot of Monty Python lines the same way you can do things from Animal House or Christmas Vacation. People can just start to do lines from movies. And for some of us, at 10:30 on a Sunday night, Monty Python's Flying Circus would come on, and then the movies came out, and you couldn't believe the wackiness and the irreverence that you were seeing. In this scene, the king is coming upon they're coming down the road. There's some mud there. The king wants to get through. There's a dark knight that's waiting. The dark knight won't let the king pass.
But I must cross this bridge.
Then you shall die.
I command you. as King of the Britons to stand aside.
I move for no man.
So be it. Now stand aside, worthy adversary.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that then?
I've heard worse.
You liar!
Come on, you pansy!
Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look!
It's just a flesh wound.
That's the line. Just a flesh wound. A lot of us will walk around with various lines for Monty Python, and for me anyway, just a flesh wound was sure one of them. He ends up cutting off all of his legs and his arms. He's sitting there still fighting from Monty Python. What a fun movie that was, and what a career, what a legacy, him. Yesterday, we spent some time talking about pizzas, strange toppings that people allow on their pizzas, put on their pizzas. You can continue to text those today. In the 10 o'clock hour, we visit with Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. I'll ask him a little bit about that, about Restaurant Week and his recommendations, and also about how best to complain at a restaurant. If something doesn't go well, what should you do to get satisfaction? And he and I were talking about that at the end of his last visit. I had an experience not that long ago, and it went really badly. And I wanted to do more than just complain. I wanted to fix it for me next time or other people that come along. So do you yell at the waitress? Do you send an email to the manager? Do they read it? Do they do anything? I mean, do you go on Yelp and complain? I don't know what the best avenue was, Phil. And he said, oh, I'll tell you what you should do. And he'll finish that at 10:30. This is the definition of chutzpah. Got a press release yesterday, Dateline Chicago. It begins this way. Saying they have years and in some cases decades of experience selling marijuana, a group of black citizens say they cannot wait on delayed government bureaucracy to establish the policy for them to land jobs in the lucrative new legalized cannabis industry. They want jobs now. The men and women, some ex-felons, have turned to T.O. Hardiman, executive director of Violence Interrupters, to assist them. Hardiman and those seeking permits and amnesty will rally and hold a press conference later today. They say, look, you allow people to vendors to sell food out of food trucks. They can drive into a neighborhood and sell food. Why can't we do the same thing with weed? Trust us, we know the market. He's kind of got a point there. He kind of doesn't have a point there. And they were walking around last night with cut pieces of fried chicken and pickle pizza. And I ate one as a courtesy, and then I ate three more because that's what I wanted to do.
Sounds like something a pregnant person would really like.
Touche, Mary Vandeville. But it wasn't. We were all eating it, and I didn't see any pregnant people there. It's 9:39. This is John. We talked a little bit about that yesterday, strange pizzas, because I went to this New Harbor restaurant on South Wabash, the 1300 block. Pretty good food over there. I meant to mention a couple of names of folks I met. Joe Taylor. Joe, good job out there. And Robert Gamboa. The people that did the woodwork were there, too. Timber Wolf LLC. Mike Weinold, or is it Weinold Mike? I forget now, but he's with Timber Wolf Slabs. And if you, for your business or home, need a cool piece of wood for a table or a long conference table or some ornamental woodwork, Timberwolf does a pretty good job of that. Timberwolfslabs.com is their name. And so thanks to all of them for what turned out to be kind of a fun conversation yesterday as you told us what your strange pizza choices are. John, we grew up poor, somebody texted today. I would take a taco, put tomato sauce on it, and slice up Vienna sausage and put it in the oven. I guess the taco would be the pizza crust, huh? John, a little tomato sauce, browned bratwurst, cheddar instead of mozzarella, chopped green onions, and sliced black olives. Great in the summer. But some of you are coming up with beets and crazy things like that, and you know, mandarin oranges. I can barely get to pineapple. Some of the creative things you all are enjoying, I'm happy for you, but that is not for me. John, I think you are wrong about these Kansas players. I think you're wrong. The Kansas player should have let the Kansas State player make the damn layup. There was only 5 seconds left. This fight you're hearing about, if you haven't seen the video, that's what it is. In basketball, if we're winning by a lot and I've got the basketball, there's no sense in you trying to steal it and score one more time. There's a few seconds left.
There's no point in doing that, and there's a backstory here. When Kansas played, I think, Monmouth back in early in the season, like in November, same kind of deal, except Kansas had an even bigger lead, and the Monmouth player stole the ball, ran down the floor, and dunked it with a few seconds. And it was like a 55-point game at that point.
Well, then I don't blame the kid.
But again, here's the thing. Don't, I guess etiquette would say just let the team that's winning dribble out the clock.
They're not trying to score on you, so you shouldn't try to score
on them. Yeah, they're not.
The game's decided.
Right. The game is over. There's no, you don't have enough time to come back from whatever it was, 21, 19 points down. But that said, there's nothing wrong if they steal the ball with trying to then prevent them from scoring. Oh, you know, that's...
Well, no, the Kansas player could have then said, all right, fine, you want to make your little basket? Yeah. Go ahead. But now his ego's on the line. You just stole the ball from me. What, you're going to show us up? So now he goes down to block the shot, which he could have let go. He could have let it go.
But again, I understand, again, the game's not over, and I understand the mentality. You play till the game is over.
I do, too.
Now, if you've called off the dogs, if you're Kansas and you've said, we're not going to try to score here, we've got the game won, they steal the ball, you have every right to try to keep the guy from scoring. But that doesn't require you to basically knock the guy down and then stand over him and taunt.
That's what he did.
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
And that's where...
So if it was a tit for tat, then it was back to another tit, if you will. And by that I mean that he should not have then taunted him afterwards. You stole the ball from me. I blocked your shot.
Yeah.
That's the end of it. But now the Kansas guy doubles down, and now he's lording over this kid on the ground.
Right. Yeah. He turned the ball over. So what are you taunting?
I know. You know. He did steal it from
now,
you.
And I understand he didn't think the guy was going to steal it. I get it. Whatever.
Speaking of sports, by the way, it says here, John, I know little about Derek Jeter and baseball, but I would have voted for him into the Hall of Fame because of that commercial with the little girl with the beads. Mm-hmm. It's so cute. That's not how they decide, but one person decided Derek Jeter should not be in the Hall of Fame.
If that's
so
how they decide, then shouldn't J.J. Watt be in the Baseball Hall of Fame too?
Yeah,
he's on that same commercial except without cleaning up a river.
Yeah. Oh yeah, right.
But nobody gets in unanimously.
Who's the only player that's been unanimously selected into the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Mariano Rivera.
Wasn't Willie Mays? Wasn't Hank Aaron?
No.
Wasn't? I'll just start to list all the great players of the last 100 years.
How about this? Babe Ruth was named on 95% of the ballots.
Wow.
That means 5% did not put Babe Ruth
in. Who
is
this one person? Who's the one person?
We do not know.
They could self-report.
It's not been identified.
They could identify themselves. If they've got a problem with Derek Jeter going into the Hall of Fame, let us know who you are and why.
And they may. They may, but they may not, because the voters are given confidentiality if they choose.
Okay. Well, it's no great disgrace. He goes in like everybody else. Nothing.
No, it's just...
Derek Jeter is not less for this.
It's just annoying.
It's just annoying.
Do you really think he doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame?
Hey, if you've got the courage, if those are your convictions, have the courage to express them and tell us why, says Baseball Land. It's 9:44. By the way, I've got a family pack of 4 tickets to the Chicago Shakespeare Theater's Comedy of Errors, with all the hijinks and hilarity of Mistaken Identities, performed in just 75 minutes, and after the show, stay for Q&A with the cast and meet the actors in the lobby. Now playing Saturday mornings through February 29th. Get tickets at ChicagoShakes.com. A family pack of 4 tickets for the 10th caller right now. By the way, during the break, Dave Ennett found the video of the Kansas-Monmouth game. The reason Kansas and Kansas State got into a fight last night, this taunting back and forth and so forth, may, as you say, be predicated in part on the backstory that earlier this season, Kansas was similarly dribbling the ball out as they were blowing out Monmouth by 50 points. And as they're doing it, the Monmouth guy sneaks in behind and grabs the ball and then runs down and dunks it on him. And then he turned to the Kansas players and he said something like, "I'm not happy with the way things have turned out today." And then they all started yelling at each other. So maybe now Kansas last night, especially with K-State on the floor, is like, you know what? That happened to us once. We are not going to be dunked on again at the end of the game.
Right. That could have had something to do with it. I just, you know, it's something, I think you put it very well. It's just kind of sneaky.
He kind of sneaks around behind, grabs the ball, and then the guy with the ball from Kansas, like, hokey smokes. So he runs down, too late to defend him, dunks on him, and the Monmouth kid was ticked. I think he was embarrassed, he was angry, and he wasn't going to graciously stand there while you dribble out. No, I'm still playing! I'm still playing! I got a press release, and it reads this way. Saying they have years and in some cases decades of experience selling marijuana. By the way, congratulations to our winner. We do have the 10th caller. We got it during the news of our Comedy of Errors prize. Jennifer, you take the tickets and enjoy them. Have a great time. Everybody else, go pay some cash and go see that show. Saying they have years and in some cases decades of experience selling marijuana, a group of black citizens say they cannot wait on delayed government bureaucracy to establish policy for them to land jobs in the lucrative new legalized cannabis industry. They need and want jobs now. The men and women, some ex-felons, have turned to T.O. Mr. Ceasefire Hardiman, executive director of Violence Interrupters. They're having a press conference today. He said, look, vendors can sell food out of trucks. We know weed and the neighborhood. How about we sell it out of a truck? I guess out of a truck? T.O., this is John Williams, and you're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad to be on your show, John. I appreciate you today.
I have to tell you, I got a little chuckle when I first read this because I get it, but by the same token, I thought, no way, no way are they going to allow this. T.O., what's going on here?
Well, this was sad to know. It's really, really unacceptable here in Chicago that we do not have not one African-American-owned marijuana dispensary. So I met with a lot of the brothers from the streets. I must admit, they turned to my for my leadership, and they said they came to me with an idea about peddler's license. I say that sounds good to me. We need to push for peddler's license because the average young guy here on the streets of Chicago, they don't have no $250,000 to open up a dispensary. And then also, it's just insane. We have an African American mayor, African American lieutenant governor, and the drug czar is African American, and we don't have no dispensaries. It's totally unacceptable. But let me be clear with the people that are listening. What I'm talking about is, everything is legal. Let this, the unemployment rate is 45% for African-American youth in the city of Chicago right now. I'm saying this way we can reduce unemployment by at least 20%. We can help ease some of the ongoing conflicts surrounding the illegal drug market. And at the same time, we might be able to reduce some of the gun violence by allowing these young men to have peddler's license so they can set up at farmers markets. They can set up in some designated areas, and they can purchase the cannabis wholesale from the dispensary, you know, the owners of the dispensaries, and it's a win-win situation because everybody can make money on legalized cannabis right now. So that's, I think it's a win-win situation for the entire city of Chicago and the state of Illinois.
How many of those licenses, I presume there would be some licensing for the peddlers, as you say, who, you're right, now that you mention it, I could see that at a farmer's market or a farmer's market. How many licenses would you like to see granted and who would get them? How would that work, T.O.?
Yeah, I love that question. So this is what I'm looking at. I think there should be like a limit every year on how many licenses are given out. Let's say maybe, I'm just putting some numbers out now, maybe let's say 300 licenses a year, and then it should cost around $250. And the people that should be qualified to receive the license are young men and women that may have been locked up for selling marijuana. Their sentences have been commuted by the governor anyway. And young guys, so some of these ex-felons, so they can have a shot at making some legal money. And everybody's paying taxes money. So that would be my answer for you
and
there.
And if it strikes people as curious that you're suggesting it'd be people who previously had run-ins with the law for marijuana, in fact, those are the people that were getting preferential treatment for the retail stores, right? So it's not so crazy to suggest that the people who were previously the criminals, if you will, would now actually be the law-abiding citizens selling the product. But they don't have those storefront operations, do they?
No, not at all. But you have to go back to Prohibition when alcohol was illegal. You had all the gangsters, you know, overseeing, you know, the bootleg alcohol industry. And when they made alcohol legal, they started opening up speakeasy lounges. They started the alcohol was being sold at restaurants. I mean, everywhere. So why not marijuana? You know, think about Grubhub and Uber Eats. We can take this on a higher level. You know, people can bring you curbside service, okay? And these young guys can make some money. I would love to see the crime rate go, the gun violence rates go down in Chicago and see these young men and women making money out here.
You know, it's funny, though, because I just it's kind of like mental whiplash for a lot of us. The scene of at a curbside, somebody pulling up and getting marijuana and then somebody else giving them cash, that's the typical crime scene that a lot of people have in their heads. Now you're asking us to legalize that, actually to be partners in that. And I think that's just a mental leap for a lot of people. I get the logic, but I think as my colleague said a little while ago, the word optics comes to mind. I think that is that bothers people a little, Teo.
Well, let me say this to everybody that does listen. It's time to flip the script right now, okay? The city leaders are searching for ways to end the gun violence. People are searching for solutions out here. And, I mean, I'm talking about it this way, but, you know, we can modify everything I'm talking about and bring it up to, you know, the current.
Are you worried? Let me ask you this. Are you worried about the cash? I mean, if somebody's in a truck or at some flea market, I'm not sure where they're going to be. But one of the reasons these places are behind locked doors is because of the amount of cash involved. They're targets for crime just standing there. How are you going to handle that, Teo?
Well, one thing about the brothers on the streets, they know how to handle themselves on the streets, okay? Just being honest with you, I don't think the young brothers are worried about that. I just believe it could bring some sort of peace to some of the communities out here. And when you look at, let's look at the southeast side, 79th and Damon, all the way to 79th and Gates. There's over 1,000 abandoned storefronts right on 79th Street. So what I'm saying, give these young people an opportunity to make some money, because there's a 45% unemployment rate amongst African-American young people between ages of 16 to 28 right now in Chicago. And we can reduce unemployment with that population by about 15 to 20%. I think it's a win-win situation for peddler's license here in Chicago.
I got less than a minute left. Mike, you're on WGN. What was your observation, Mike? You're on the air.
You know what, John, I agree with a lot of what this gentleman is saying. I mean, I think it's very unfair the way all of a sudden the politicians have figured out, oh, it's okay for us to make money off of pot now or marijuana. And the thing is, it costs some extraordinary amount of money, $250,000. I think that's just for the application. It doesn't guarantee you anything. And you could, I think there's, you could possibly lose that as well.
I got to say this. A lot of people are agreeing with you, Mike and Rich, on another phone line. I'm out of time, but T.O., the first flush of calls and texts here think you may be on to something. We'll be listening for that press conference. Good luck to you later this afternoon.
Yeah, I appreciate you very much for having me on.
T.O. Hardiman's got a press conference. They're going to make their case loudly later today. You may have been following that story in the news, some gruesome-looking pictures, but also just a bizarre story. This woman, Corinne DiLorenzo, ran an animal sanctuary. People sometimes rescue pets. Sometimes pets are rescued but given a place to live out their natural lives. They're not adopted. They go to a sanctuary. She ran the sanctuary. And it sounds like terrible things were happening there. Investigators have found out about it. It was a fascinating story in the Tribune, but it left a lot of questions unanswered to me. A woman who worked with DiLorenzo is going to say hi to us in about 10 minutes and fill in as many of those blanks as we can. That bizarre story coming up. Before the news, we were talking to this this enterprising fella named Teo, Mr. Ceasefire Hardiman. He's the executive director of something called Violence Interrupters. So I think we know what he's all about. But he's also saying that if we're going to start selling marijuana and the African-American community is being cut out on the retail selling side, we should do something to better enable people to sell pot on the South and West sides. He said there's plenty of brothers who know a lot about weed. They've been selling it for years, decades, some of them. Let's let them get in on the business too. Oh, wait, they don't have $1 million to start up a business. How about we let them peddle it the way they used to? They could sell it now at flea markets or farmers markets. They could sell it out of the back of a truck. He's going to have a press conference later today to talk about that. Rich wanted to jump in here and say something about that. Rich, you're on the air. What can we do for you?
Well, I actually agree with this concept for several reasons. One is, in some of the neighborhoods he's talking about, nobody's willing to invest that kind of money to open up a business. Two, by making it more affordable, he could serve the people he's talking about that will help them get into the business. And bottom line is, think of it like this, is if it costs a lot of money to get into the business, you have to raise the price of your product. And I'm not saying, oh, cheap weed would be great because personally I don't use it. But the bottom line is, if the way it is now, if you make the cost of products so prohibitively expensive, there will still be a market for illegal sales. The same way that right now, alcohol is legal. I could go to my corner Walgreens and buy it. But yet, there are still people making and selling moonshine because untaxed liquor is a lot cheaper. So you will still have an illegal weed market just for cost, and this might help get rid of that illegal weed market. At least that way, it'll be regulated. It'll be licensed. You'll know who's selling it. And again, like I said, they get into the business and they don't need a $250,000 or $500,000. Like you said, make it like a food truck. Make the licensing more affordable and help these guys get ahead in the business or in any business. Because let's face it, anything is better than going back to a life of crime and going into prison. Because when you're in prison, you're a tax on society. If you're in business, you're helping society.
A couple of folks have said stuff like this. Rich, thanks for the call today.
Thank you.
By the way, there was a story in the Tribune or Sun-Times, I think it was yesterday. You know why a lot of people, I don't know a lot of people, some people are not going to the dispensaries or the retail stores is because the tax. The guy that's been selling it to you illegally all along, he's not taxing you. I just remember January 2nd, whatever it was, after sales went up, people started to send me their receipts. So the one I have on my phone right now, it was $70, $70, $70 for the three purchases. So that comes to $210, $220, something like that. I thought the maximum was $200 you could buy, but that's the picture I saw. And then the tax for a little over $200 came to $300. It was like $85 a tax on top of $220 worth of purchase. $80 for that one purchase. Might last you a while, but here's another way to not pay $80 additional. Buy it on the street. And I don't know how many people are still staying with their old supplier, but I understand the math on that. If you were happy with the product you were getting before and you had a relationship with them, maybe you're going to keep doing that. To which Tio says, well, how about you let us in on the game, too? You can comment on that. 312-981-7200 is the number to text. What else was I going to mention here before we go to break and then go on to this bizarre and kind of sad story? Steve, I saw the Mama Malnati obituary in the Sun-Times. Yep. Maureen O'Donnell wrote it. I guess it's an obituary. It's funny because they say she passed away January 3rd. So here it is a few weeks later, and they're telling a story about it. It says here she was a registered nurse who learned the secret of making good pizza dough from her husband, who died, Mrs. Malnati, who died, she was 93 and had been in failing health, according to her son, Rudy Jr. Though Mama Malnati helped her son develop the thin crust of Paisanos, he said he never switched her allegiance from deep dish. She left explicit instructions on the food to be served at the upcoming celebration of her life. Quote, I don't want that damn thin crust pizza. The only thing I want served is our original deep dish sausage and cheese, says Mama Malnati. There's two branches of the Malnati family. This isn't the branch associated with the Malnatis as you know it today, more the Paisano side of the family. But sounds like a character and an interesting lady passed away this year. It's 10:15. Okay, so now let's just catch you up on this strange story about this animal sanctuary where they've found hundreds of animal remains, and the woman there isn't talking, but a friend of hers is. Phil Vitale's the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune. Restaurant week's coming up. He's got 30 don't-miss restaurants. We'll ask him about a few of those. How to best complain to a restaurant, and Phil, what's your favorite pizza topping? Headline in the Tribune the other day. Peter Nikias wrote this story, pile of bones, a deadly fire, an animal cruelty arrest, unraveling what went wrong at a former Illinois Animal Sanctuary. About a half hour's drive from Kankakee is the location for this animal sanctuary in a town you and I may never have heard of called Thawville, Illinois. The woman who ran it, Nakia says, was Corinne DiLorenzo, or Corinne, C-O-R-I-N-N-E, has been indicted on a felony charge of aggravated animal cruelty, and the Illinois Attorney General's Division that oversees charitable groups is also investigating. People who no longer can or will take care of their pets can have them rescued. Sometimes they're fostered out and adopted by other families. Sometimes they go to a sanctuary where they live out their natural life. Dogs, cats, rabbits, horses, goats. It's all kinds of animals that people discard in their lives. This is a place they went to, and it sounds like they were not being well cared for. Now, this lady's been very quiet, DiLorenzo. She hasn't talked to anybody since this story went public. Melissa Pena is on a phone line, and Melissa worked with her. Hey, Melissa, it's John Williams. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, John. Thanks for having me on.
Everything I've said so far is kind of true, right? That's where we are right now?
Yeah, that's exactly where we're at right now.
And what was your role? What did you have to do with this place?
Well, Corinne was a friend of mine first, and then in 2014, she started Earth Animal Sanctuary. Prior to that, I was kind of just doing animal rescue, just on my own, working with, you know, various rescues. I foster for House Rabbit Society of Illinois and Red Door, and just different rescues around the Illinois area, transporting and whatnot. And then in 2014, Corinne had moved out to Thawville and started what was Earth Animal Sanctuary.
And I have to ask you this early on. Do you know her to be a mentally well person? I mean, if it's a person who's unstable, all of this makes sense. But they found the remains of hundreds and hundreds of animals there, and it doesn't look like they were cared for well. Was she okay?
Well, I mean, as far as I knew, she was okay. I mean, Corinne had never presented herself as anything other than what I, you know, always thought that she was, which was a loving person, a person that cared for animals, and somebody that I never would have imagined that could hurt an animal. In hindsight, you know, that's really not who she was, as we kind of have been going through this, and different aspects of her life have revealed themselves. One of the women that has been working with this, working on this with me, her name is Dr. Marion Willits. She's a associate professor of sociology at ISU, and she's somebody that knew Corinne from her past, and she had given her professional opinion and said that Corinne fits the profile of what's called an exploiter hoarder. And it's my understanding, I had never heard of anything like that, and I guess looking back, it now all kind of maybe makes sense. An exploiter hoarder is somebody that acquires animals to fulfill their own ego's needs, kind of like, look at me, I'm doing something wonderful.
Yeah, right.
Situation.
Well, that maybe, yeah, I mean, literally, that's why I ask about her mental health. My producer, Elif, this morning Googled multiple personality disorder.
Right.
She presented herself as a lot of things with a lot of ambitions. You told me off the air she wanted to be a singer. No, she wanted to be a chef. No,
yes.
She wants to rescue animals. And in the process, when she's moved on to something else, she's got a lot full of horses and dogs and cows and things like that that now aren't so interesting to her. Do we know how the animals died?
We don't know exactly how the animals died. Unfortunately, they were, you know, the remains were too far gone for any type of necropsy or anything like that to happen. But we did have an archaeologist come out to the area where the animals were found, and they had kind of sorted through the remains that we found, particularly the skulls, and they had given an age to each of the skull and each of the skulls, and they had what they had come up with was most of the animals were young when they had died, which isn't right. I mean, animals go to sanctuary, you know, with the intention of them living out their natural life, you know, to old age. So, you know, the large quantity of animals, you know, having died young is highly suspicious.
Who was turning the animals over to her?
Well, I know that she had gotten the animals from like various animal control facilities.
In the Chicago area or throughout the state,
kind of throughout the state. A lot of that came from the Chicago area. Various counties. Individual people would reach out to her that, you know, hey, my pig, I can't care for it anymore. You know, it grew to be too big and I just can't afford it or whatever. And they would turn the animal over to her, you know, in good faith, thinking that this is where their, you know, beloved pet would be for the entirety of its life.
And Melissa, the name of that was the Earth Animal Sanctuary. How was then she supposed to have the money to take care of all these animals?
Well, she was taking in donations throughout this time. And one of the things that had kind of come to light through all this is that the 501c3 was involuntarily dissolved in October of 2016 due to non-payment of taxes. And that's something that, you know, none of us that were you had been working with her in the past had known.
That's a red flag.
She'd been taking in donations after that.
You were on the board of that organization?
Yes. Early on, from probably about 2014 when she started, till about 2016.
Well, Melissa, the pictures we see of this place are deplorable, and it's so bad that DCFS said her teenage son is not allowed to live there. It was a wooden floor. There was animal excrement around. It was one of those instances where people are not mentally well or they're drug addicts, and now they're just living in squalor. You didn't see anything like that?
No. When I was the times that I had been in her house had been, you know, earlier on, and later on I had no, you know, real reason to go in the house when the animals, you know, were outside. So the photos that I saw were, you know, absolutely shocking to me. I mean, feces on the floor, I mean, squalor, what you would just, you know, picture on the, you know, that television show Hoarders, what you see people living in, filthy conditions, electrical wires hanging.
Right.
I remember reading, you know, the sheriff investigators' reports, and they said that the smell was indescribable. So that, the DCFS had stepped in and they had gotten a warrant to search the house, and, you know, because of her son, and they had made her son, leave the premises until she made some repairs. And unfortunately, when he was able to return, the repairs were very minimal that she had to make, you know, pretty much just clean up the wiring and whatnot.
That's not a well person. So she's not in jail, though, now, right?
She's not in jail. She was arrested on Christmas Eve at her home, from what I understand, she's not living on the sanctuary property. She no longer lives in Thawville. She was arrested on aggravated animal cruelty charge, which is a Class 4 felony, and she posted her bond out the same day, so she had to pay 10% of the $10,000. She's out on bond and, with pending court dates. And from what I understood, she has asked for a trial by jury.
Okay. Well, good luck to her on that. So here's the deal. If I give my pet or my goat or whatever to, I'm not exactly sure who, some animal rescue organization.
Sure.
I'm hopeful that they are attentive to the conditions that those animals are going to be sent to. Can you comment on that, Melissa? This is troubling.
I can. I just want to say that, you know, the people that I know, you know, and that I do work with, and, you know, that are in, you know, the animal rescue community, their heart and soul is in it. You know, this is what they, you know, they live and breathe this kind of work. And, what I recommend to people, you know, that are looking to, you know, maybe rehome their animal, even if it's with another individual, not necessarily even a rescue organization or sanctuary, you want to make sure you do your research, ask questions, ask for references, visit again, you know, have eyes on it for yourself and know where the animal is going, and just not take somebody's word for it that you know, that they are going to be going to a good place, because this is, look at where we ended up.
Well, we haven't heard probably the last of this lady. She's not talking to the press. She and her attorney aren't available. And you are one of those people that knew her as a friend. Then she's into this animal rescue thing. You were too. You worked with her. And then it sounds like something clicked. Something went wrong. And that's where the story is today.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you know, what went wrong is the question. I mean, ultimately, you know, I don't know for sure. We don't know for sure. But, you know, my opinion is that, you know, I think she lost interest. And I think that, you know, she had started a new career in the process of all of this. And I think that the animals kind of took a back seat.
Right.
And they were, you know, ended up being neglected and not fed or not fed enough. And then neglect led to illness. And, you know, without any medical intervention, the animals started dying. Yeah.
She is obviously able enough. You told me off the air. She's an independent business person. She's in insurance. She's got a job. She does well. So I'm not exactly sure what that tells me about her and her abilities, but one last question. Mm-hmm. The archaeologists and you were there, found a couple hundred animal remains. How many total animals do we think were in her care that died there?
We believe that there are still about six or 700 the animals that are still missing. Because what we had found on the property were only about 200 animals.
That's amazing.
So there's a lot of animals missing, and that's the question that everybody wants to know. Where are the animals? You know, that's what everybody's just been asking. Where are the animals? Where could they be? You know, what happened? What went wrong? And, you know, Corinne has never come forward to speak on her behalf, and that's the odd thing. It's just that's what makes everything so suspicious, is that she's never come forward. She's never made a statement on her behalf. She never reached out to anyone that cared about her.
You've tried to reach out to her.
Yeah, absolutely, on numerous occasions, and she just never returned the text or the phone call. You know, the last thing that I had said to her was like, "Just let me know what's going on. Just let me know that you're okay." And she never responded. I think throughout all of this, at the end of 2018, she reached out to one person and sent a text that just said, "I'm okay." You know, and that was really it. But then I hadn't responded to anyone.
Yeah, I'm out of time. She's in her 40s, it looks like?
No, she's late 30s.
All right. Good luck to you. Thanks for coming on. This is frustrating, but also helpful. And I really appreciate your insight into all of this, Melissa.
All right, John. I appreciate you having me on.
Best to you. Melissa Pena works with, she formerly was with that organization, Earth Animal Sanctuary, and at least knew that lady personally. WGN, this is John Williams. By the way, I posted on my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John on social media. Just a quick update about that trip that we are going on with our friends from Kelly Cruises and a couple dozen of you WGN radio listeners in October. It's going to be a swell trip. We will start in Ephesus. We'll go on to are we in Athens? Boy, I don't know. Santorini. We'll go to Dubrovnik, which I've never been to. I don't even know where it is, but it's fun to say Dubrovnik. And then on to Venice for a couple of nights. And it's really going to be a swell trip. The details are on my Facebook page. There's just a handful of suites left in our group. And we would love it if you could join us. There was one other point I was going to make about that. Anyway, I'm WGN King John on Facebook, and some of the details are there. Oh, I remember what it was. It just kind of came to mind because I was Googling around and saw that Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones and their family were at one of the stops that we're going to go to this month. Earlier in this year, they were in Ephesus. It's that famous ancient ruins with the old library, the columns lining the street. They're all made of marble. They had sophisticated art and condominiums. The public bathhouses are still there. It's just amazing to see this city unearthed, reconstructed, and you don't have to stand back and look at it. You walk down those same worn streets, thousands of years old. It's really remarkable. I saw them there, not to name drop, but I thought, well, if they can do it, and they have unlimited resources, heck, you can come with us too. KellyCruises.com for our October trip. Phil Vitale, have you ever been to Ephesus or some of those swell places that I'm talking about?
I have not.
You should travel more.
Yeah, probably.
Use that one right there, Phil.
Thank you.
There you go. How are you?
Good.
Phil Vitale is the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune and joins us many Wednesdays at this time. Incidentally, we just did the news story about Yelp putting the health inspection reviews of restaurants.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I think it's probably a fine idea. I mean, I wouldn't want, you know, I wouldn't want this to be a crowdsourced kind of thing. But if it's from the city inspectors, then yeah. You don't want a bad score up there, then clean up your act, and literally clean up your act.
Most restaurants, though, that don't do well on those health inspections, when I read the reports, they say they had mayonnaise out, and it wasn't kept at a proper temperature. Mm-hmm. Or it was there's a lot of temperature violations, and sometimes there's the segregation of things, and they're too close to each other, stuff like that. And I think, heck, I do that all the time at home. I mean, I just think that we hold restaurants, as we should, to a higher standard. But a bad health inspection score doesn't mean it's a horrible place and you're going to get sick.
Exactly.
It just means they weren't attending to some of these important details.
Right. And especially depending on when the inspection takes place. I mean, if you hit somebody at the lunch rush, it's going to be one violation after another because refrigerator doors are opening and closing and all the rest of it. And it's hard to maintain temperature.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, the standards are there for a reason. But yes, if a restaurant that I knew and respected had gotten dinged, it probably would not change my mind or my motivation. Not short term.
Is that what you were going to say, Steve Bertrand?
Well, I was going to say, who would want to go to a restaurant that not even the mice like?
Right. That's an endorsement of sorts.
Right.
I mean, but even that, say they find evidence of mice. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's droppings, sometimes it's a mouse, whatever. I've had mice, too.
Yep.
You've had mice. Mice, there's more mice than there are us. So, yeah, mice might be in a restaurant, and I don't think that's a horrifying thing.
Not if it's just one time. What happens in those instances is they find evidence of a mouse infestation, and they're pretty easy to see because mice tend to go where they eat. So they just kind of say, "I've been here." They leave a calling card. That you usually what happens after that is the restaurant owner gives a panicked and furious call to his exterminator and says, "What the heck?" or words to that effect, and let's get in there and double check.
Fix that right now. Speaking of dinging a restaurant, so I told you the story last week, on and off the air, but towards the end of the conversation, I wanted to just revisit it. Last fall, we went to a restaurant that we really like, and we had a bad experience. And we left and just thought, oh, well, c'est la vie. And it wasn't any one thing. It was just the whole business at that restaurant didn't seem to be as well run as it should have been.
Right.
The food, the service, the cleanliness of the place. It's a nice restaurant. And so I thought, you know what? I almost feel like I need to reach out to them as a fan and say, hey, you guys, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know exactly how to do that. If I tell the waiter or waitress, I don't know where that's going to go. It's not a locally owned business. It's a corporation with a bunch of restaurants across the country. So I don't know that even I sent an email once to the local manager and never heard back from them.
Mm.
And that was when I had another complaint about that place. And I'm never a complainer. I don't normally do this. But again, I'm a fan and I want them to stay good because I still want to go there. I don't want them to slip. So
right.
I thought, I'm trying to help you out here, guys. What's your advice for me?
I think you're doing everything exactly right. I mean, probably the best time to get the manager's attention is while you're still there. But manager, and no smart manager, no good manager ignores a letter from a guest.
An email?
Email should be just as good.
But nothing wrong with typing something up and putting it in an envelope and sending
no,
it to the manager.
Email is perfectly fine. Make sure you're talking to the right person.
I don't know who to email, but I guess
right.
I can figure
and
that
if,
out.
You know, if you can't get a hold of them, if the manager doesn't ask and you say this is a large regional or national chain, then there's a regional manager. And somebody up the chain should be paying attention. And, I mean, I understand that if you just sit there, got a lukewarm sandwich that you wanted to be piping hot, there are limits as to how far you're going to take this to let people know. I think what you did, you sent a letter and said, you know, I got to tell you, I've been here a few times, and the last time was really disappointing because of this and that, and I thought you ought to know.
I'm not looking for a discount. I'm not looking for a coupon. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking for anything. I really want to help them. I don't want to go there and it not be good.
You should have gotten a response saying, thank you very very much for taking the time to alert me to this. I will share this with the team, and we will take whatever steps. Please come back to the restaurant and ask for me by name when you come in. I would like to make this experience up to you.
So I ordered my family this week, a place where we order in a lot. Love it. It's one of my favorite places, and it's absolutely consistent. And we opened up the box and the pizza.
Oh, I know what happened. Yeah.
It was never seen anything like it. It was there were some areas where the sauce wasn't there, or the crust was burned through, kind of. There were black spots in it. Just wasn't an experience I'd ever had at this place in eating there for 25 years. I was going to call and say, hey, I don't want anything, just giving you a heads up. And my family kind of talked me out of it, thinking I was going to get some 17-year-old kid in trouble.
Well, that 17-year-old kid is going to bring the whole business down if the manager doesn't find out that things are going wrong. I would have called and said, hey, I just ordered a pizza. You know me. I'm here all the time. And this is terrible. I don't know what happened, but somehow, I mean, it's not some 17-year-old. I mean, somebody had to cook that pizza and not notice it was wrong. Someone had to box it up. Presumably,
that's true. There's more than one person who
somebody should have seen that and stopped it, unless it's all messed up because the delivery guy was making too many hairpin turns and slid all the cheese to one.
So, Steve, I picked it up.
You didn't, Steve? Then you didn't make the call?
So I didn't, no.
But it's also kind of a hassle, right? Like,
it can.
You know, it's easy to get lazy about that, even though you're...
And then it's like, no, hey, no, I don't want a free pizza. I don't. Well, sure, I'll take one. That's fine. You know,
actually, you do want a free pizza. You ordered something, you picked it up, and it was terrible. And you said, I've got people I'm trying to feed, and this stuff is inedible. I want a new pizza, and I would like it really soon, please.
Do you trust Yelp reviews like that?
No. I'll be honest. I don't read Yelp reviews. They're anonymous. I've skimmed a few, and some of them you can tell that are written by someone who has some sense of how things should go, and they can articulate what is wrong. But too many of the ones I've skimmed say things like the all-purpose non-information information. It really wasn't that good for what you spent.
I look sometimes
at just nonsense.
I get that, but I look, Phil, sometimes. Phil Vitale's here, restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. You want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear you. You can call or text. I look at the number. So if it's 273 people have posted reviews on Yelp or whatever site, that to me is going to then take into account the competitors who are trying to just put up bad posts.
That's true.
I'll bet the competitors didn't do it 200 times. It's probably a pretty fair assessment. And then if after 200 reviews, their score is 4 stars out of 5, I think, okay, this place is pretty good. I kind of rely on that sometimes.
All right.
I you know, I don't know what else to do. If I don't
have
a review from Phil Vitale.
Right. If you've had some experience in which the reviews you read are borne out by your later experience, saying, you know, these guys kind of...
They got
that right.
Yeah.
And you're right. The more the numbers of reviews for any given place, the more likely that the extremes have been flattened out by sheer numbers.
Exactly.
Just by sheer numbers.
Phil, you've motivated me. I'm going to write a thoughtful letter to this restaurant that I had a bad experience, and I will report back to you on what happens. Now, if I do that today, next Wednesday,
sure,
maybe they will have reached back out to me.
Bit better.
yeah, that quick a turnaround, huh? I'll let you know what happens.
Right. And I've talked to restaurant owners, in particularly Scott Worsham, who has Barbas K and MFK, who are two of the best restaurants in the city. And he points out the frustration of someone, of a customer who, when he stops by the table, says, yeah, everything was fine, and then goes back home, gets on the keyboard, and writes a blistering Yelp review about this was wrong and that was wrong. And he said, I don't think people realize how much those flaming reviews upset the algorithm that Yelp relies on.
When the manager comes by, or the owner, and sometimes the restaurants, they will. Hey, this isn't your waiter, right? So you assume it's somebody way up the food chain. And they go, how's it going? Is everything good? And they just give you a minute of chit-chat, seconds of chit-chat. It's kind of hard to go, well, as a matter of fact, the potatoes aren't the way I like them. I find myself invariably just saying, oh, it's great.
Right.
Even if it's not great, because I'm going to finish my salad and get out of here eventually, so I don't want to do this right now. But I guess, again, if we were just good customer citizens, we would do them the favor of being completely candid in that scene.
And the restaurant owners and the managers, if they're being honest, they're saying, please give me the chance to make it right. You think it's a big confrontation?
Yeah.
I'm not going to give you an argument.
Yeah.
If that salad isn't exactly what you want, let me know. I'll have a new salad to you in no time. I would much rather have you go out thinking, hey, this guy
tried
really
to fix it.
Did something to fix it.
Should
up
he send over a free Manhattan to me as well?
I don't know. Depends on what I mean. If this is part of a big meal and you've got some people and you've had a drink, sure. What the heck? Send a drink. I mean, they've got their own thresholds of what they will do to make people.
Yeah.
But I remember Rich Melman told me once. He laughed. He said, "We send out a lot of free stuff." That's how you make people. That's
happy.
How you make people happy. I mean, you think of it. Their cost for a new salad is nothing compared to what you're about to spend there, what you can spend there for the next 3 years if they can get you as a regular customer.
Here are 30 don't miss spots to try during Chicago restaurant week, says Phil Vitel. I'm reading from the Tribune. That's where you write. Let's run through some spots you're recommending after this. By the way, I had some pretty good pizzas by the Phil Vitel, restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune, at that Harbor restaurant on 1300 block of Schubert. Or Wabash, rather. Wabash.
Okay.
The other night. I might go there again this evening. They served a fried chicken and pickled pizza.
Interesting.
Which led our listeners to then tell me about the strange toppings. They have other kind of pizzas there, but that was one they were just showing off. And it was pretty dang good.
Was it spicy? Because it sounds like it might have been kind of like a fried chicken sandwich turned into a flatbread.
It's exactly how Steve Bertrand put it. He says, well, then that's just a flatbread. Whatever it was pretty dang good. The pickles gave it the punch.
Right.
It was really delicious. What's your go-to pizza topping?
My go-to pizza topping? I'm kind of a spinach and mushroom guy. I'll tell you why. I grew up Catholic back in the old days when Lent meant Lent, not this wishy-washy Lent they have these days. Not just Lent, but I grew up when every Friday was Meatless Friday, not just the Fridays in Lent. Every Friday was Meatless Friday. So
really,
yeah.
Wow.
As a kid, that's what being Catholic was.
You are a holy man.
Nah, there's a few holes in that theory. But that meant for eating, in my family, that meant one of three things. Either what my mother did to fish, which was an offense to God in and of itself, or something like a grilled cheese sandwich, or going out for pizza. Well, going out for pizza was the huge treat. But we're having pizza. Why? Because we're not allowed to have meat. So to this day, I'm a little weird about meat on my pizza. To me, pizza is a meatless dish because that's how I grew up. That's why it was such a treat.
Yeah, what do you know? Tomato soup and grilled cheese sandwiches, or tuna sandwiches.
Right.
The thing was, I always felt a little cheated's not the right word, but my mom loves salmon. My mom would always order the fish anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So those of us who would like a hamburger, well, now we got to figure out what to get. While mom's just going, I'll have the mahi-mahi or whatever it was.
I'm having what I always have.
I know. It's like,
I'm getting bonus points for heaven.
How is this a sacrifice?
Thank God Lent's finally here.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to give up my children's happiness and eat salmon.
Okay, so for how many years have you been doing Restaurant Week?
The first Restaurant Week was in 2008.
I say you because you're the instigator of this. 13 years ago, you said, let's have a Restaurant Week.
I wrote a column, yes, saying Chicago needs one, pointing out that not only did New York and, say, Washington, D.C. already have one, but some little towns had one. I said, come on, we can do this. It's a pretty easy format. Everybody follows the same format. Let's do that. And possibly coincidentally, but I don't care. I'm taking total credit. The city council had a meeting and established a committee. And by next year, the following year, 2008, there was a Chicago Restaurant Week with all of 35 restaurants.
How many will be in it this year?
More than 400.
Wow.
So we've had a nice run the last 12 years.
Starts Friday, and Restaurant Week runs 17 days.
Yeah.
Goes to February 9th, where they offer what? Special menus, special prices?
Yes. They have either a lunch, which will either be two or three courses, depending on the restaurant, and that'll be priced at a fixed $24. They have weekend brunch, some of them, and that's also $24. And then at dinner, they have usually either three-course dinner or a four-course dinner, and they'll be priced either at $36 or $48. And they're usually printed up as a separate menu that's at your table when you arrive. and the regular menu is still available, so you're not like locked into this menu if you want, because there are restricted choices naturally for the price range. But it's a great way to sample restaurants at prices that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to eat at, and it's a great way also for restaurants to entice people to come out in miserable weather.
Yeah. And, I think your point is well made. Some of us aren't going to go to these places for cost reasons or geographic reasons, but if the price is good and the menu is enticing, then it's your chance right. to sample.
And it's not so much of a commitment. It may be that you're perfectly willing to spend that kind of money at, say, Belmore, rather than going to lunch there and having a nice $24 lunch, but if you went on your own, you'd probably spend more, and now you've got the incentive to try it out for much less.
Here are some recommendations for, let's do lunch first. Of the 400, you pointed out a few. What do you like for lunch?
I like Avec, I always have. I mentioned Belmore. Coco Pazzo in the River North is very good. At this inside the Museum of Contemporary Art, there's Marisol, which is a lovely restaurant in a very pretty place.
And really good food.
Yeah, so good. Sepia. Over on West Loop, they do lunch and dinner, and Woodwind, which we've talked about before, which is just a few blocks north of us here.
Which one is a Woodwind?
Woodwind is in the part of the Northwestern Memorial Hospital.
Oh gosh, yeah, right.
Thing, up on the 18th
floor.
So that
made your list. Good for you. Good for them.
Yeah, because you can get. I mean, they're open for dinner too. But especially my lunch recommendations, I was thinking more of the downtown area where people are more likely to go out for lunch.
You know, speaking of pizza, and it seems like we have a lot lately, I recently discovered Marie's. I was at Harbor mm-hmm. the other night. I might go to Harbor again tonight. But we go to Roberts sometimes now, uh-huh. which is here in, what is that, River North?
River East Arts Center, they like to call it now. Right. It used to be North Pier, which I can understand, but now it's River East Arts Center.
It's next to that Winter's Jazz Club, mm-hmm. And that's a good combo.
Yep.
And that made your list for a terrific idea for lunch on Restaurant mm-hmm. Week. On dinner, you've got a bunch. What do you like for dinner?
Dinner, I like Barbusque. I was talking about Scott's restaurant earlier. He's got a $48 dinner menu. Bar Sotano, which is in the basement underneath Frontera Grill. That's it's a basement bar with a lot of interesting cocktails, mostly based on mezcal, but they also have a very, very interesting food menu as well. There's Elche Steakhouse out in out west of the Loop in Westtown. And then classics like Harry Carey's Italian Steakhouse. It's probably several locations. I focused on the one on Kinsey Street. And good old Lowry's The Prime Rib, which we have talked about from time to time. And Macello, which is out 1200 West on Lake Street. They're doing a nice $48 dinner menu where you can have some antipasti and one of the pasta kind of dishes, then your main course, and then your dessert, which is an awful lot of food.
The some of these places offer up charges because if you do want to get the steak as part of the Restaurant Week, if it's a certain cut, then they might give you a bit of an upcharge, but it's still it's a less expensive menu or a different menu for some of these items.
Mm-hmm.
You do have for brunch Bar Siena and Siena Tavern.
Right.
They do a Saturday brunch. You mentioned Beacon Tavern, which is downtown. That's just by where the Sun-Times building used to be,
exactly.
Over by Trump Tower.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to point that out to people because you will not see that walking up and down Michigan Avenue.
No, you can't.
And yet, if you just go off of Michigan Avenue, right there at the Michigan Avenue Bridge, where the Wrigley building is now, kind of and head west a little bit, right?
Yeah, you're just going in that little plaza where the Wrigley building splits. There's the two, you go in between that, and there's this lovely little plaza and a little patch of grass, and then in there are a couple of restaurants, including this Beacon Tower.
Back in the day, it was Don Roth's River Plaza, right?
Is that what it was?
Very good, yes. Yeah.
Ding, ding, ding. Have you been to this place, Steve?
I have
Beacon
not,
Tavern?
No.
You know, you can get a beer there, a cocktail, you can get sandwiches, salad, steaks. It's a good place for not crazy expensive lunch or dinner, and you can look out onto the river, as I recall, and it's just a little bit of a, if you're looking for a little tavern experience downtown, I think it's a little bit of a gem that people don't know about.
Kind of an upscale
Beacon Tavern.
Upscale decor too, a lot of dark walls,
right.
With white trim, very 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 Pottery Barn catalog kind of insides.
Good way to put it. 405 North Wabash. I'm out of time. Elif just said break. break.
She just wants a break. She's been listening to me too long.
I don't think that's the case. I think it's me. Okay, so ChicagoTribune.com/dining. Nice to see you, Phil.
Thank you. My pleasure.
As always, we appreciate your thoughts. Phil Vitale joins us on Wednesdays. NBC is going to have their streaming service to the Peacock, and then you've got the Disney one and the Apple one, and you've got Netflix, and you've got all of these options, and I don't blame you if you're a little confused by what these things even are, how you get them, what are the charges, what's available on them, and then what's a consumer to do? Which of these services and channels should you watch? Which should you pay for? We'll try and sort some of that out for you after 11:30 here on WGN. It seems to me like January, February are very much TV watching or streaming service watching months because the weather's not great, and that's kind of what we do indoors. Mike Hammernick, just give me a minute of your time. Are you there, Mike? Good morning. How are you?
Hey, John, I am. Good morning. How are you doing?
Meteorologist over at WGN. Mike, we've been hearing about a few days of snow, and it sounds kind of on and off starting, what, today or tomorrow?
How about tonight? Looks like around midnight or so. That's when the snow is going to kick in. So I think we're in pretty good shape for today. Not anticipating any problems, but the first flakes expected to fly in the western suburbs around 11 p.m. or midnight and then gradually work their way across the area tomorrow morning. So by this time tomorrow, everybody should be seeing some type of snow. But it's going to vary from light to moderate. It's mostly going to be a light snow, so it's going to take a while to add up.
Yeah,
we're not looking at a superstorm or anything like that, but the flakes will be flying tomorrow.
Yeah, right. And then, so you get a little of that tomorrow, and then the way I'm hearing it, it's kind of on and off for a few days. What do you think the total accumulation is going to be?
Yeah, it's a slow-moving storm, and it's got a lot of moisture. The thing it doesn't have, it's not a real powerful system, so it doesn't have the ability to squeeze out all that available moisture. So I think that's going to limit the snowfall total somewhat. We're also going to see some rain mix in on Friday with the snow.
Yeah.
So snow mainly on Thursday, then rain mixed in with the snow on Friday. So that's going to hold down the total somewhat. So I'm thinking, you know, we're probably still in that 2, 3, 4 to 5 inch window as far as total snowfall accumulation. Although some areas north and west of the city could end up with a little bit more than that. But I'm thinking from the city, the west, south, and into northwest Indiana, we're still within that maybe 3-4 inch window as far as how much we're expecting from the system total.
Yeah, well, 3 to 4 inches this winter feels like a lot to me, you know.
Yeah, we haven't had that big mega storm yet. And
are you rooting for one? I would rather have just give me one of those. And what the hell, it's January. Don't do it in May, but I'll take one now. Give me 13 inches of snow. I think that would just be a lot of fun.
We're talking about mid to late Saturday morning, though.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
and I want it. Right. I've had my coffee. We get this monstrous snow. We shovel. We have hot chocolate. We visit with the neighbors out front. That whole scene. Can you get me one of those, Mike?
I don't see one in the cards yet. But you know, we have that sweet spot. Over the last 10 years, late January and early February, the first week of February, has been kind of the sweet spot for the big storms here in Chicago. You know, we had the Groundhog Day blizzard. We had the Super Bowl blizzard, you know, in the last decade. So we're in that sweet spot, you know, as far as the big storm is concerned. But right now, it doesn't look like this one is going to be that storm.
Yeah, no kidding. Although there is something to the adventure of a rush hour weekday monster snowstorm too.
Yeah,
I don't want anybody to get injured, but I'm just saying
that
because then you have those epic stories. It took me 2.5 hours on the Eisenhower. I had to walk seven blocks. I remember some of us were almost trapped downtown one year. We got a hotel and stayed overnight because if we got home, we were pretty sure we weren't going to get back. A little adventure is good for the soul,
and that's what saved us from the Super Bowl blizzard. We got 20 inches of snow out of that storm, but it happened over the weekend. Everybody was home. Nobody really had to go anywhere, stay home, watch the game. So it didn't have the impact that those weekday storms do. So you're exactly right. Those weekday storms do turn into be a much more of an epic type of storm than the weekend ones.
Okay, next few days, starting midnight tonight or so, western suburbs first, of course, and then through the metro, 2, 3, 4 inches, maybe a little more depending on where you are, and maybe a mix of sometimes snow and some frozen stuff, rain maybe too. Okay, Mike.
On Friday, and then ending with snow on Saturday again, a little bit of snow, and then we're done for a couple of days.
Okay, buddy, good to hear your voice. Thanks for the help.
All right, John, anytime.
Mike Hammernick over at Channel 9, WGN-TV. 11:14, a couple of texts have poured in about pizza, of course. John, we were in Siena, Italy, and had a pizza with a fried egg in the middle. See, this is what it is. We all decide that Italy owns true pizza, but I've been hearing from people who were in Europe and have had various kinds of crazy pizza. John, Jimmy's Pizza Cafe, Lincoln Square, bacon, dates, and walnut pizza. Good stuff. John, I picture the guy who didn't vote for Derek Jeter to get into the Hall of Fame sitting in his mom's basement, and he looks like Newman from Seinfeld, signed Tina.
Don't you think Newman thinks that no one should get in on the first ballot? That's what he's going to stand on?
Is that what it must be?
Yeah.
Because you cannot look at that man's record or the way he comported himself. He's everything you want a baseball player to be.
Or the bead commercial with the little girl.
That's what somebody said. Give it to him for the bead commercial alone. I don't know that I've seen that. Which one is that? Can you describe it?
He comes upon a little girl and she's selling bracelets that she's making, and so he sits down and says, "Can I help you?" And I think it's an ad for WGN Radio. I don't know what it's for.
and he's adorable and she's delightful,
right,
and so forth.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking about the Kansas State dust up last night. It was more than that. It was a Donnybrook. It was a real kind of like old time baseball fight, a scrum of people, punches and chairs being thrown.
Guy had a chair above his head.
Yeah.
It was hard to tell if he picked it up to throw it or how it got into his hands, but he was still holding it over his head.
When somebody then, assistant coach or somebody, kind of wrestled it away from him. And by the way, he gladly gave it up. I maintain that was for show, but that's the picture on the front page of the sports sections today, is him holding the chair up ready to do damage. I don't know what's the matter with me. I watched that thing many, many times last night and today. And there needs to be severe penalties. But I'm not one of those people that say this guy should never wear a uniform.
Uniform.
Yeah, exactly. I am not one of those people.
No, I kind of agree with you on the chair thing, because it was weird how it ended up in his hands and then he easily sort of said, what am I doing with this in my hands, kind of.
Just think we can't imagine what it is like for players in those amped-up moments to not for a second make a bad decision.
However, hundreds of them played last night, and only those guys made that bad. And it wasn't a second. It went on for a long time.
For
it was bad.
About 15 seconds of bad. 30 seconds of bad.
Several punches thrown.
847 said, John, why is no one talking about the Illini player?
Yes, I know. I was going to bring it up.
Who was ejected from the game last night for stepping on an opponent laying on the floor. How is that any different? Unsportsmanship seemed to run rampant last night.
Well, not in Milwaukee.
We'll pick it up here in a minute. How did Marquette do last night, Steve?
You know, they beat St. John's, which isn't always easy for them.
It's 11:20, so we're maybe 40 minutes if they start on time with day two of the impeachment. It's still sort of the negotiation for how the trial itself is going to take place, as I understand it. But these are critical decisions that are being made. Senator Schiff said yesterday that what you're about to see is not representative.
Chairmanship,
yeah. He said the most important decision you'll make is not the guilt or innocence of Donald Trump, but rather how the trial proceeds, because it's this decision that will dictate the fairness of that second decision. The other side had plenty of points to make. It was point counterpoint. But we'll let them get at that in about 40 minutes. This is what John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who is presiding over it, said late last night as they were continuing to squabble.
I see a lot of senators.
Oh, pardon me.
Voting.
Yeah, so I'll turn it off, because the first voice you hear is, so what you're about to hear is the Democrats.
Gerald Nadler.
And then Scipione, what's the Republican?
He's the White House counsel, so he's the lawyer for the White House.
So you got one, you got two, and then you got John Roberts. It's the back and forth.
I see a lot of senators voting for a cover-up, voting to deny witnesses, an absolutely indefensible vote, obviously a treacherous vote.
Mr. Nadler came up here and made false allegations against our team. He made false allegations against all of you. He accused you of a cover-up.
I think it is appropriate at this point for me to admonish both the House managers and the President's counsel in equal terms to remember that they are addressing the world's greatest deliberative body. One reason it has earned that title is because its members avoid speaking in a manner and using language that is not conducive to civil discourse. In the 1905 Swain trial, a senator objected when one of the managers used the word pettifogging, and the presiding officer said the word ought not to have been used. I don't think we need to aspire to that high a standard, but I do think those addressing the Senate should remember where they are.
Pettifogging. Never heard that phrase before.
Got my mouth washed out with soap when I said that the first time.
It sounds nasty, I'll say that, but I'm not sure what pettifogging is. But whatever it is, we shouldn't be doing that. I was hopeful when I heard that John Roberts scolded them that it would be a little more scoldy. A little more, hey, you guys, are you kidding me? Nobody's just buying this crap. You're embarrassing everyone. Shut up.
I think he did say that in his way.
I guess he did, but there will be no more pettifogging today. I think there will be plenty of pettifogging. Kevin, you're on WGN. What can we do for you? You're on the air.
Hey, Kevin. Hello, John. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I called in because, was it Steve was telling you about a Derek Jeter commercial a couple minutes ago?
Yeah, the little girl in the beads. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I just felt like I had to call in because he left out the most precious part of the commercial.
What was that?
So she set up like a little Kool-Aid stand on the sidewalk, and he walks up to help her, and she's doing it for charity. And he asks her, how long you've had this dream? And she goes, 10 years. And I'm not sure if I got the wording right, but he says, well, that's quite a dream for a six-year-old to have a dream for 10 years.
Yeah, that was sweet.
Yeah, yeah. And does anybody remember what they were selling in this commercial, Kevin?
AM 720.
I think she was making bracelets for a charity for children.
Yeah, yeah, okay. But I'm still kind of at a loss to know. So then are they selling me a cell phone service or a sneaker or whatever? I want to support whatever it is Derek Jeter's selling, but I don't know what to buy now, you know?
I believe it was insurance.
Yeah, I think it was an insurance
American
company.
Family Insurance, I'm thinking.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks for the phone call. The one that I have been enjoying, literally enjoying. In fact, last night I was watching the game and this commercial came up and I missed the beginning of it, so I rewound the game to catch the full commercial, which we don't normally do. But it was the commercial where the mom is sitting there with her cat, and you hear upstairs a kid call out, "Mom, I fell." And then the mom says, "Okay." And the kid says, the mom says, "Get a Band-Aid." And then the kid upstairs goes, "I'm bleeding." And the mom says, "Okay, get two." And I think a lot of us have been to that. You could tell by the kid's voice that what they really want is some attention. And the mom is reading a book and the cat's there and she's having her moment. And so she says, "Well, then get two." And I thought that just rang so true of that scene. I don't know what they were selling, but I do like that commercial. Do you know the one I'm talking about? It's 11:26. I just wanted to plow through a couple of other text messages or email that we got here. You know, we were talking about food truck style pot vendors on the South Side. I may craft a news click about this. We visited with a guy earlier on the show today. His name is Tio. He goes by the nickname Mr. Ceasefire Hardiman.
Well, Tio Hardiman he's an activist, and he's run for office several different times.
I know the name. Yeah. I've never talked to him. He seemed to be very well-spoken and rather pleasant, Steve. He runs Violence Interrupters. So you know who Tio Hardiman is, right? I'm afraid I don't, but he's advocating for letting young men and women on the South and West Side, I guess, to sell pot the same way the stores are now, at farmers markets, out of trucks, at street corners. He imagines 300 of them, say, with licenses, and they would pay a small fee for the license, not $250,000, maybe $200, and then they would go out and sell the marijuana street corner to street corner, as they have in the past, he says, so they know what they're doing. And I got questions about that, but I kind of like what he's doing there. Not everybody agrees, of course. The big problem would be collecting the tax. And I think what would have to happen is those vendors would have to pay the tax for the wholesale, right? So maybe that's what's happening anyway. So if you buy it from the wholesaler and it's $100 worth of pot, you have to pay $130 for that pot because that's the tax. Then you sell it for whatever you want to sell it for on the street or out of your truck or at the farmer's market. And now we've eliminated those sort of barriers to retail that a lot of these people are experiencing. So that's his angle on this. And the first wave of emails and texters said, by golly, that's a good idea. The next batch of them did not. And just I wanted to mention this. Somebody sent me a picture of the house they used to live on Wood Street, South Side. And here it is. It's kind of run down. There's an empty lot next to it. Some overgrown, looks like trees or shrubs nearby. And it's boarded up. It was probably a great old brick building once upon a time. It's not anymore. The texter wrote, oh, John, when is this state going to stop the black-white issue? How about Mayor Lightfoot give the black community an open door to put back an investment in their communities, which are primarily crumbling? Not pot, but investment where it matters. Here's a picture of my home years past, sitting like a broken trap. And there's somebody's home. Yeah, I don't know how you're going to help these neighborhoods and these people and houses like that. But introducing pot vendors on the street, I don't think is the solution either. I just like the entrepreneurialness of what this guy came up with. It's 11:29. After the break, how many, that is the news, Steve will do it here in just a second, how many different streaming services do you or will you subscribe to? Like at our house, I don't even know. I think we have HBO. We've got Netflix. I watch Comcast. We have Amazon Prime. But there's many more things we don't have. And now NBC has a pretty good lineup on their new Peacock service, which is going to come out in a couple of months. And they're going to have the Olympics, too. So what about this? There's a free version, a $5 version, and what you get for the $10 version is clever. You can get the $5 version, which comes with all the bells and whistles. And if you give them another $5 a month, the $10 a month version, you get the $5 version, but with no commercials. I'm not exactly sure what that means. We'll answer all those questions after the news. By the way, Steve, we were talking about that guy that wants to sell the marijuana out of the back of his truck,
right,
or wherever. John, if they start selling pot from food trucks, that would give a new meaning to the phrase Roach Coach.
Yes.
Hold on a second. Be a new meaning to the phrase Roach Coach.
Boom. By the way, if you're paying for the streaming, why do you have to pay extra not to get commercials?
Well, because I guess you do get commercials with this. If you're streaming
but
a show.
That was a part of paying for a streaming services. You don't see commercials.
Right. If I'm paying $5 a month for this, I guess you can get some of it for free. This is the new NBC Peacock Network. Opens up this spring, and then they're going to roll out all sorts of stuff. And I guess the fact that it's coming out before the Olympics is going to help highlight this new service that you'll just have to have. And I think they're going to have a lot of the old NBC shows, too, which is good because there's some classic shows that people want.
Well, Friends was pulled from, I think, is it Netflix at the beginning of the
right.
year?
Right. This will have Friends.
Right.
So you're going to have it. So then you say, okay, I'll give you $5 for that. Now, are they going to take the commercials out of a Friends broadcast? Or is it no commercials in between? Well, there aren't commercials in between shows. It's a streaming service. It's not a broadcast. I'm confused. Maybe John Salzman can help us. Joan is a senior reporter at CNET. Hey, Joan, it's John Williams, and you're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I'm good. I'm here to help.
You know, if you tell people what you do, you could probably never escape their clutches. They ask you a million questions about services and technology these days, right?
I love it. I love helping people figure out this even more confusing landscape right now.
Yeah, I wonder if we're going to look back at, say, 2020 as a very transitional time, that in the near future, 10 years from now, this will have all settled. The players will be players and the pretenders will be gone and we won't have 75 options. Or do you think this is the way it's always going to be, this sort of a la carte series of streaming options, and you're just going to have to pick the services that you want.
You know, I don't think that. I think there's definitely going to be winners and losers in this fight. But the ones that we're mostly talking about when we're talking about things like Peacock or HBO Max or Disney Plus, and of course there's the Netflixes, the Hulus, the stuff that has been around for a while, all of those companies, they're throwing billions of dollars into these services. They're making huge bets, and you can pretty much bet that they're not going to let them fail without a fight. So the things that are going to suffer are some of the smaller, more niche services. If they can't, you know, go up against the firepower of these big tech companies, and they don't have a built-in audience willing to pay and find them without those kind of marketing dollars.
Well, let's talk about this NBC Peacock, which caught our attention. And let's start with my colleague's question. There's a free service, a $5 service for everything, and then a $10 service for everything without the commercials. Well, shouldn't the $5 service offer me that, Joan?
Well, the $5 service, it's very confusing. The $5, both of the paid versions, both the $5 level and the $10 level, they basically unlock content that you can't get on the free version. So things like the original series that Peacock is making on the free version, you'll get little snippets. You'll get maybe one episode or the latest episode, something like that, but you won't get the whole series of these originals. There's also other content that they're going to hold back for these paid tiers. And then you're right, the difference between $5 and $10 is whether you watch it with ads, whether you have this all-access pass with advertising, or if you have this all-access pass with no ads included.
So if I'm watching an episode of The Office, or I'm just looking at some of the things they're going to offer, Two and a Half Men or Friends or whatever, will there be commercials in those episodes?
No, if you're paying that $10 amount, then no, they won't have any commercials.
So you could just binge watch that stuff all day. They're going to have 15,000 hours of programming plus original content. And if it's some of the good old NBC stuff, that's pretty good stuff. Plus, who knows what they're going to come up with. So, okay, I'm in. $5, $10, whatever. But I'm already...
You'll be able to sample it for free, too. That's kind of the angle that they're going for. Most people aren't doing this, you know, kind of on-ramp to subscription with a free product. But Peacock's doing that. So you can sample it, see what you like, and see if it's worth paying for.
Who are the major players in the streaming services?
For sure.
Give me the obvious answers.
Right now, everybody, I mean, the dominant one is Netflix. Just yesterday, Netflix announced that they are now at 165 million subscribers worldwide, which is the biggest of any service on the entire planet. Everybody knows Netflix. They're the biggest. And so all this talk about competition with Netflix, it's something to keep in mind that nobody's going to be catching up with Netflix for a really long time. With Netflix, you also have kind of the round of... kind of diehard streaming services that have been around about the same amount of time. That's things like Hulu, that's things like Amazon Prime Video. Then you have this category of traditional networks that have launched a streaming service. So those are things like HBO Now and HBO Go, or Showtime streaming app, or CBS All Access. Those have launched a while ago, and they're based on those traditional networks that you are familiar with. And then we have this latest wave of new streaming services, and that includes things like Peacock, Warner Media is going to be launching HBO Max to replace HBO Now, and it actually is what's going to have Friends. So we're confusing enough. Even though you associate Friends with NBC, you would think that'd be on Peacock. It's actually going to be on HBO Max. So, yeah, clear as mud. And then, of course, we had Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus in the fall. So I'm sure it's all perfectly clear now.
What's the jury say about Disney Plus and Apple Plus or whatever they are?
Well, it depends on what metric you're looking at. Certainly, it's hard to deny that Disney Plus didn't hit a home run. They had more than 10 million people sign up in just a little bit more than a day after launch, and there are analyst expectations that they've hit 25, maybe even 30 million, far outstripping the amount that they had expected to have. Apple TV Plus has not shown nearly as much interest, but it's a different thing that they're going for. Apple TV Plus is kind of doing a slow burn, where the point of Apple TV Plus is to get people into Apple's ecosystem. They're dangling these stars in these really big budget productions to get people into their app rather than to necessarily get people paying them money for those subscriptions. It's all about being a platform for Apple, whereas for Disney and some others, it's all about owning that viewer and having the direct relationship with somebody who pays you for mm-hmm. your content.
So you've mentioned to us here in a couple of minutes' time 11 different services. And I know that's not all of them. Does anybody aggregate them? I mean, that doesn't exist, right? That's the point. There's no one place I can go and get all of them for one bundled discounted price or for free for that matter, right?
Right. That thing's called cable, sort of.
Okay, but I mean, I subscribe to Comcast, but
right.
I have Comcast in my home, but that doesn't mean I get these services for free. I won't get this Disney stuff, will I, or Apple, or?
Not included. Yeah. What you're talking about, yeah, as you said it, those are bundles. That's bundling. And there are some cable companies, these traditional pay TV providers, Comcast is a great example, that haven't made it quite to the level of bundling, but Comcast with Xfinity, you can at least access Netflix, YouTube through your Comcast remote. You don't have to switch inputs. It can be just right there. But what you're talking about, yes, that's bundling. And I don't think that if we see that happening, it's not going to be for a really, really long time. Because, you know, part of the point of having these streaming services is that the companies that launch them want to have that direct relationship with the viewer. They want to build the loyalty directly with them rather than being in this gigantic bundle, which is essentially what cable has always been. It's been a gigantic bundle of networks, and that led to a lot of, sturm and drang from consumers. I pay, you know, $130 for my cable subscription. I watch 5 channels.
In a way, we've moved toward a different type of bundling, right? I mean, because now the bundles are smaller, but you still have to buy multiple bundles to see everything you want to see.
Yeah,
and it feels, you know, it's not a price-saving thing. That complaint, you know, I pay for 7 billion channels, but I only watch 5 or 12 or whatever it may be. When you have to pay for just those 5 or 12 individual services, if you even have the option to get them as individual services, it adds up to be pretty expensive when you factor in that you need to have a mobile phone, data plan to watch it, or you need to have an internet broadband connection to watch it at home. So it's not even a cost-saving issue at this point anymore. It's becoming an issue of availability, being able to stream things when you want them, where you want them. And cable companies are trying to be more progressive on that front, some more than others. But that's one area where streaming services and networks and other companies, by launching streaming services, are trying to establish that they have an advantage.
I'm going to read some text to you. Joan Salzman's on a phone line. She's a senior reporter at CNET. Our phone number and text line is 312-981-7200. But, you know, to me, the $64 question is then, I don't even have to have a TV to watch all of these things. I can watch them on a device, or I can get a TV, I can have Comcast, and then I can additionally subscribe to these services. So I want to watch my games, and I want to watch some of these terrific shows. I mean, there's great programming out there. But do you have advice for me? Should I not subscribe? Should I not even have a TV and just individually purchase these streaming services? Or should I go with the 200 channels I'm getting with Comcast and then cherry pick one or two of these services?
Well, there's two things, I think, going on in what you just said. One thing you mentioned is you like to watch games. So that means you're a sports fan, or you have sports fans in your family, and that makes cutting the cord, so to speak, really difficult, because live sports haven't moved over into this streaming world yet. That's mostly because live sports are so lucrative for networks based on advertising that they haven't been willing to move over to these subscription models, where subscriptions have to be kind of low. You know, we have an ESPN streaming service, ESPN Plus, but it doesn't have any of those programs that you would get ESPN for with your cable subscription. So that makes, in your case, that makes cutting the cord difficult. And then the other thing that's at play here is this consideration of, do I even need a TV? And even though most of these services, these streaming services, you know, people kind of associate them with watching on the go or watching on your phone, the vast majority of viewing of Netflix content, Disney Plus content, it's on the biggest screen in the house. And as you said, you can have a device or even just a smart TV itself to watch all those things on the TV. So it's not necessarily part of your consideration, like, do I need to even bother with a TV? It's really a consideration of, do I need that live sports with a cable subscription, or can I make do cobbling together these on-demand sort of scripted entertainment options on my own?
Well, I, you know, and if I may, maybe people are like me, but I got to watch my games. And so that's a non-starter. So I guess I should have the most basic cable package. Hopefully it'll include the sports channels I want. They don't necessarily do that. So now I'm in for 100. And then, doggone it, well, you want to watch Game of Thrones, or you want to watch this series or that series. And so now you start to add them up. So let me come back with some text questions from our listeners, and maybe you could just help me decide how to shop. Do I need to pick shows, or do I need to pick services that seem to be the best, like Netflix, say? 312-981-7200. Joan Salzman from CNET's our guest. From CNET, senior reporter Joan Salzman's given us just a few more minutes of her time. We're talking about all of the streaming services that are out there. NBC's Peacock is coming online, and when I started to total them up, I thought, I'm thoroughly confused. Joan, listen to this this text message. It says, John, this is so confusing. Figuring it out is like a part-time job. I don't even watch that much TV. Remember when you just changed the channels or got a video? I understand that, but at the same token, we didn't have as many great shows back then either, did we?
No, there's been an explosion. There's too much to watch is almost a problem. That also sort of adds to the confusion. At least it adds to the noise. You hear about so many different series has got a C's. There's so many things getting awards, and there's so many things that are getting these big budgets that it's impossible to keep up, or it feels impossible at least. And yeah, I can say from experience, definitely is impossible to keep up with everything that's coming out.
Yeah, but I mean, so you don't work for any of these services, but boy, if you picked one, it's hard not to make that Netflix, right?
Netflix is definitely the standby. It's the one that has the biggest library of any service, and it's also the furthest along in creating original content just for its service. You know, certainly Disney, you wouldn't say Disney isn't, you know, they have a 100-year history of creating content and a long legacy of making new stuff, but not all of it is going straight to Disney Plus, their streaming service. You know, Avengers movies, they're going to be going to the theater and they're going to stay there for 6 months before they come to Disney Plus for people to watch with their subscription. So,
well, if I do, I'm going to do Netflix. Give me, what's the next one I should get?
I mean, it really just depends on the things that you're interested in. And one thing about these services is that you can dip in and dip back out. They don't have any contracts.
Oh,
you can,
yeah.
Usually they have a free trial. And so if you want to jump in and see whether or not you like an original on Peacock, you can see if you like it. If you don't, you can just unsubscribe. So you don't have to commit long-term to any of them.
847, John, we cut the cable tie and get Hulu Live, a small handful of channels, and we still get live sports. It's the best of both worlds. Hulu is confusing to me. Is that true, what this texter wrote?
Yeah, you know, Hulu has not only what people traditionally associate it with, which is on-demand, sort of next-day viewing of a lot of programs from things like NBC and Fox and ABC. It also has this live channel streaming service. It's basically like a streaming version of a cable package, where instead of paying Comcast for your live television channels, you're getting them with Hulu alongside that whole library of on-demand stuff. And if it weren't confusing enough, now that Peacock is launching with NBC, that could jeopardize NBC programming going to Hulu down the line. It's not going to happen for a while for this person who's texting. Now, that's not something you have to worry about right away, but it could get even more confusing going forward.
Okay, 708 says, hi, will I be able to watch the Olympics on regular TV, or will I have to have the Peacock?
No, you will definitely still be able to watch NBC's coverage of the Olympics. That's, I mean, where most of that coverage is going to be. Some considerations, though, are that Peacock will allow you to, because, you know, obviously the Summer Olympics are happening in Japan. That's a time zone that's completely opposite what the United States is on. With Peacock, if you wanted to watch things live, you'll have more ability to see them streaming instead of waiting for the U.S. time zone's primetime broadcast on NBC. So basically, Peacock will give you more flexibility in what you particularly want to watch, but there's definitely, NBC is going to be, you know, they spent billions of dollars to get these rights. They're going to have a really splashy primetime presentation of Olympics coverage every single night.
Yeah. Boy, if ever a network showed off, it's for the Olympics. Mary, you're on WGN. What was your question? You're on the air, Mary.
I don't know that I really have a question, but a comment. The way I watch TV, and I only watch on my TV, not an iPad, not an iPhone or anything, but I have never had cable or satellite. I'm in a condo, and we have a five-story condo. We have a good rooftop antenna, so I still watch plenty of TV, over-the-air TV. And then I just do stream. I subscribe to whatever streaming channels I'm, you know, interested in.
How many channels do you subscribe to then?
Probably like five or six.
And what's the average cost of those? Are they all about $5 a month, something like that?
Yeah, 5 to 10. And some I simply pay for annually. So once it's paid, you know, once a year, I can forget about what I'm paying monthly.
Yeah, you know, Mary, you bring up a point that I wanted Joan to speak to, and that is that what I should expect to pay, Joan, about $5? Maybe it's not that expensive. If I'm in for $100, I'm in for $150. Maybe I shouldn't worry about it. What's the cost on these?
Yeah, most of these services are priced between $5 and $15. Peacock, with its ad-supported all-access pass, quote-unquote, that's the $5 end. And then on the more expensive end, it's things like HBO Max. That runs at about $15.
Thanks for the call, Mary. Barbara had a question, too. Barb, you're on WGN. What can we do for you, Barb?
Yes, I have a question. I have the satellite on the roof. And, of course, I've got the one with the 200 channels. I'm thinking I should go down to the very basic dish service and then pick up some of these other Hulus or Netflix or whatever.
So your question is, how do you get that on your TV? Can you talk to that, Joan?
Yeah, so if it's just a matter of figuring out how to get the streamed content onto your television set, that's simple as if you have an internet connection into your home, you can attach a streaming box to your TV. That's something like a Roku. There's lots of companies that make these. Roku is one. Apple TV is a box like that. And so it just depends on how fancy you want to go with it, how fast you want it to be. But any of those things will be able to make your television be able to stream that content.
Barbara, good luck to you. I know that all sounds simple to Joan, and I kind of understand that. I do. But I also know that very explanation is confusing to people. You just use the word Roku, and I think this is a company somebody should start. It's a service. I come to your house, I explain this to you, and then I hook you or sign you up for what you need. I think a person could make money with that as their service.
Maybe I should moonlight in that.
No, actually, you do a very good job, Joan. It's nice to talk to you. You can read her, CNET.com. Joan Salzman is a senior reporter there. I sure hope you join us again, Joan. It's been nice talking to you today.
I'd love that. Thank you so much.
Gee, what have you guys got coming up this afternoon?
Well, very excited to be talking to an exceptional investor who launched her own venture capital firm, is a woman of color looking to change business as usual, and is under the age of 40, John Williams. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
I feel like an underachiever.
Oh, well, I am. Trust me, that ship sailed for me a long time ago. I'm like, yeah, somebody else figured it out before I did. That'll be a good conversation. So you're going to do that out of the gate?
Yes. Yep. In the first half of the show. And also, we're going to be talking about a really cool chore app.
Tour app.
Chore app, like a C-H-O-R-E, for kids.
Oh, yeah. More good ideas coming up.